Welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. Our program today is For the Beauty of the Earth, a Christian Vision of Creation Care. That's presented by Dr. Stephen Boma-Prettinger from Hope College. So he'll be making a presentation, and then we'll have our usual time for questions and comments and discussion. Before we begin, Gordon Doss is going to offer a word of prayer.
Thank you, Lord, that we can gather once more to think and pray and dialogue about your world. Teach us how to be better stewards of it and guide our discussion in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. As we get started, I'd like to share with you a few sentences taken from a hymn by Fred Kahn that seemed appropriate for our topic today. We cry for strength to say no to all that is mean, designs bearing chaos, extinction of life, all energy wasted on weapons of death. We lift up our hearts for children unborn. Give wisdom, O God, that we may hand on, replenished and tended, this good earth, preserving the future. Our next forum meeting is February 9, right here in Chan Shun Hall. The topic is Creation in Scripture, presented by Dr. Harold Weiss, who has been gracious enough to swap times with another speaker who had a conflict come up for next month. Dr. Weiss is, some of you probably know, as Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. And his book of the same title, if some of you want to look at it before the meeting next month, is available for Nook and Kindles electronically, and is also a paperback version you can get from Amazon. The book surveys basically what Bible writers say about creation throughout the Old and New Testaments. It argues basically that we ought to look beyond just the Genesis narratives and look at what the wisdom literature, Psalms, Romans, Corinthians, Colossians, Hebrews, Apocalypse, and so on have to say about creation. And I found it a very enlightening, broadening read myself. Anyway, March 2, Dr. Ante Jeronik will lead a panel discussion on Miroslav Volk's work, Exclusion and Embrace, a Theological Exploration of Identity, Otherness, and Reconciliation. And just to remind you, there are logs in the back where you can put down your name and email address if you're not getting email notifications of our meetings and would like to. And thanks again to Jim Harris, who helps us with the technology and audio and recording and website, and Terry and Debbie, who work behind the scenes to get out the publicity information for us. And thank you to those of you who contributed financially to our chapter last year. Well, today's presentation is For the Beauty of the Earth, a Christian Vision for Creation Care. Dr. Boma-Prettinger is Professor of Religion and Director of the Environmental Studies Program at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, up the coast from us. He holds degrees in several fields: mathematics, computer science, philosophy, theology, as well as a PhD from the University of Chicago in religious studies. He's published numerous books and articles and reviews dealing with theology and ethics and ecology. His book, For the Beauty of the Earth, received a Christianity Today Award of Merit as one of the best books of the year, and it's kind of an evangelical treatment of a theology of creation care. At Hope College, he chairs the Department of Religion and directs the Environmental Studies Program and teaches and administers and all the other things that go along with the academic life. On a more personal note, his wife, Selene, is a marriage and family therapist, spiritual director, and an ordained minister in the Reformed Church in America. And they have three daughters and lots of pets. So with that, thanks for coming down and sharing with us.
great to be with you on this snowy day. A good time to be inside and to talk about caring for creation. Briefly, a bit about the book that was referred to, one of the books, For the Beauty of the Earth, now in its second edition, The Christian Vision for Creation Care. There are eight chapters in here, and I'm going to be summarizing for this talk much of what's in chapter 7. But chapter 1 is about eco-literacy and what's called an ecological perception of place. Chapter 2 is an attempt to take the vital signs of our home planet. My students call it the thoroughly depressing chapter because it's all about deforestation and species extinction and climate change and things like that. Chapter 3 is an historical analysis of why we have the problems we have, in an attempt to rebut the so-called ecological complaint against Christianity, which is a series of arguments that essentially say we have the ecological problems we do because of Christianity. Chapter 4 is a serious attempt, an in-depth look at five basic biblical texts from the Old and New Testament. Chapter 5 is a mini theology and ethic. Chapter 6 focuses on what I call ecological virtue ethics, which is the topic actually of a book I'm working on right now, taking that chapter and expanding it much greater depth and breadth. And as I said, chapter 7 is a summary of a number of different reasons or arguments to be earth keepers. And chapter 8 is a kind of meditation on hope, which I guess is appropriate for someone who teaches at Hope College. So just a little background about that particular book. My talk is entitled, as you can see in the screen behind me, Why Care for Creation? 10 Reasons for Being Earthkeepers. It should be about 40, 45 minutes long, and I look forward to your questions and question and answer time when I'm done with this presentation. Show of hands. I'm a classroom teacher, so this is audience participation. How many of you breathe? All right, come on, get your hands up there. Everyone breathes. 100% participation. Let me just remind you of the mechanics of breathing. This gas called oxygen goes into our mouth when our diaphragm, pulls our lungs, opens it up, so oxygen goes in, and out goes our waste gas called carbon dioxide. We're doing it all the time without realizing it. And now that I've called attention to it, you're probably aware of your breathing right now. Big inhale, exhale. Oxygen in, carbon dioxide out. We take it for granted, this miracle of gas exchange. I know at least one person here is a medical doctor. There may be some others. I know some other biologists may be more familiar with this taken for granted process of the human and other body. Well, here's the other side, right? Photosynthesis, another miracle of the world in which we live. Sunlight from our star, the sun, takes about 8 minutes to get here, traveling the speed of light. You know how fast that is, right? 7 times around the world to the equator in 1 second. That's how fast light travels, 186,000 miles per second. Yes, I was a physicist in an earlier life. That was my computer science, math, physics. It was my undergraduate degree at Hope College, but I got liberal arts, just like Andrews University students, I suppose. I hope, right? Whatever your major, you're getting liberal arts. So sunlight arrives on those solar panels we call leaves. That's what they are. Miraculous devices, really. Solar panels. And that tree is sucking up water and minerals from the soil and taking in our waste gas, carbon dioxide, and producing energy in the form of sugar and releasing through those little holes, thousands of them on every one of those solar panels, releasing our fuel, oxygen, for every cell in our body needs it in order to run. Why is this important? Oh, I forgot this slide. Haven't been to this part of Australia, but the town of Unley apparently has decided to adopt a tree. Look at all these tree huggers. And I don't see a dreadlock or a Birkenstock or any granola in these pictures, despite all the stereotypes about what you have to do to be a tree hugger. Partnering with the community to promote sustainable landscapes, the city of Unley in Australia. What's the point of these slides? The first reason, the first argument to be an earthkeeper is if you breathe, thank a tree. That's my version of it. The fancier version in the language of ecological ethics is the self-interest argument. Goes something like this. If we don't protect the Pacific yew, that's a tree that is native to the Pacific Northwest, there won't be any Taxol, and more women will die of ovarian cancer, because Taxol is a drug that you can extract from the bark of mature yew trees and saves the lives of about 12,000 women in this country alone every year who suffer from various forms of reproductive cancer, like ovarian cancer. I'm told by my biologist friends now that this drug is synthetically produced, so we don't have to cut down any yew trees anymore. What's the point? Half the drugs in your medicine cabinet back home are from the natural world. Half of those are from the neotropics. Drugs, medicinal drugs, uses of things that save human lives from the natural world. Drugs like Taxol. Or where I'm from, I can't speak for Berrien Springs, but in Holland, Michigan, I asked my students, where do we get the water? Where does our water come from? Because they need to know where their water comes from and their waste goes, if you are to be properly eco-literate in this world in which we live. Those are just two of many things that you need to know, I think, to be eco-literate. Most of them don't, including people who grew up in Holland, Michigan, don't know that their water comes from Lake Michigan. A pipe about 9 feet in diameter, a mile offshore, underground, right near Tunnel Park, if you've ever been to Tunnel Park on the north side of Holland. But there's a tunnel through the dune out to the beach. And about 3 million gallons a day pumped through that pipe, then treated at the plant just down the street, and then through subterranean miles, thousands of miles of pipes to the drinking fountain right outside the classroom or down the hall in the bathroom in the dorm. I lived in Chicago for 7 years, Toronto, LA, Chicago, three of the four largest cities in North America. That got old after a while. I'm not a big city person. But in Chicago, if you drive up Lakeshore Drive, south to north, you see these cylindrical-looking objects to your right, to the east, offshore. What are those things? Those are the water pumping stations, because the 12 million or so people who live in Metro Chicago also get their water from Lake Michigan. And virtually every other community on that lake, 20% of the Earth's surface fresh water is in the Great Lakes. I'll repeat that. 1/5 of all the fresh water on our surface of our planet is in those five lakes. Half of it in one lake, you know which one. The deepest, the coldest, Lake Superior. So whether it's a Pacific yew tree or a body of water like Lake Michigan, this argument's pretty simple. We should care for creation, because if we destroy or even severely diminish certain creatures like yew trees or parts of creation like Lake Michigan, our own existence is imperiled. Self-interest, pure and simple. That's the first reason to be an earthkeeper. Here's a somewhat iconic photo. This could have been taken in many, many places around the world. One generation teaching a younger generation, in this case, how to plant food. Or here's another one. Fight global warming, do it for me, conserve. The whatever that is, appropriate name for that garment, that shirt on literally a newborn baby. Or here's a whole company called Seventh Generation. This is their logo. Seventh Generation. They could have gotten this from the Bible. I don't know much about this company. I haven't done that much research, because seven, of course, is the biblical number of perfection or completion. It shows up all over the place, from the 7 days of creation in Genesis 1 to the seven churches that John the Seer writes to in the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. Seven's everywhere. Seven I Ams in John's Gospel. The sabbatical year is after 7 times 7 years, every 50th year. How many times are we to forgive? 7 times 7, or is it 77? The Greek's ambiguous. The point is, as many times as necessary. Well, the great law, the Haudenosaunee, one of the Iroquois Confederacy tribes, where I take students every May backpacking, whitewater rafting, and canoeing and kayaking in upstate New York and the Adirondacks. The Confederacy tribes there, one of them was the Haudenosaunee, and this was their great law. This is the moral maxim of their tribe. In your every act, in your every deliberation, consider the consequences, take a guess, to the blank generations. How many? 7. Consider the consequences to the 7th generation. Assuming a generation is 20 years, imagine today if we in our families, at our colleges and universities, in our states, at our country, in our country level, if we made decisions based on the effects for the next 140 years, rather than next business cycle, next quarter, or next election cycle, 2, 4, or 6 years, take your pick. Decisions based on 7 generations. How would that revolutionize the way we live our lives, the way we run our country, our state, our business, our educational institution? What's the point? The second reason to be an earthkeeper here is what I call on loan from our children, otherwise known in the language of ecological ethics as the future generations argument. Here's a t-shirt I got from my good friend Paul. We've known each other for 37 years. We met at Hope College, and we've raised our families together. We go paddling together. He gave this to me as a Christmas present some years ago. This is what it said on the t-shirt. We not only inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. I give quite a few talks like this and elsewhere. I've never yet met a grandmother or a grandfather that doesn't fervently hope and actively work in such a way in how they live that they leave the earth at least as good, if not better, for their children and their grandchildren. I'm not yet a grandparent, but I have 3 daughters. One leaves for France on Wednesday for the next who knows how long, Hope College graduate. And it's very exciting. I don't know when I'll see her again. Do we not, we parents and grandparents, try to live in such a way to leave the earth at least as good as we received it from our parents and grandparents? I've alluded to the fact that I lead wilderness trips. I did that professionally for 4 years when I was much younger, but I still teach a college course, Ecological Theology and Ethics in the Adirondacks, with 10 or 11 students and 3 other instructors. And our motto on the trail is, take only photographs, leave only footprints. To leave the places we stay overnight, camping, at least as good, if not better, than they were when we found them. In fact, we pack out other people's trash when we find it. Try to make the place a little better. That's the on loan from our children argument, the future generations argument. Care for creation because we owe it to our children and our children's children. Here is, some would say, a motto of our culture. We just went through its high holy days. It's called Christmas. When I was young, it wouldn't start all the Christmas ads until after Thanksgiving. Well, now it's, you know, before Halloween, or so it seems. I shop, therefore I am. And those of you who know a little bit about philosophy know this is a riff on Descartes' famous cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Well, no, I shop, therefore I am. I lived in L.A. for 4 years. My wife and I did Masters of Divinity degrees at Fuller Theological Seminary, and I learned quickly that Los Angeles, among other things, and maybe some Angelenos here, I don't know, but it's the land of the automobile and the land of the bumper sticker. I still remember a couple bumper stickers from my days in L.A. You are what you drive. We were driving an 87 Chevette at the time. And I believe that bumper sticker, my ego would have, self-esteem would have taken quite a hit, I suppose. But, of course, I don't believe that you are what you drive. Or my favorite, bumper sticker. Whoever dies with the most toys wins. I'm not making that up. I'm not a bumper sticker guy, but if I had one, this would be my retort to that one. I've never seen a hearse with a luggage rack. Have you? Never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul. I shop, therefore I am? Really? I mean, every Christian ought to immediately go, really? That's preposterous. Focus on the top third. You may not know what that is, so take a look at the middle third. And, of course, the bottom third gives it all away. This is a work of art by a very creative and now relatively famous artist by the name of Chris Jordan. When you get back to your computer, wherever that is, Google Chris Jordan. In about 30 seconds, you'll be introduced to his artwork. The top photo is actually an artwork about as big as that screen, both these screens actually, and it contains 2 million plastic beverage containers. 2 million plastic beverage containers. That's the number of beverage containers used in the United States every 5 minutes. And the sound effects that you just heard are appropriate. That's astonishing. Because where do plastic beverage containers come from? What are they made of? Petroleum. Where do they go? Usually after one use. To a landfill. When do they biodegrade? A long time, yeah. A couple hundred years, maybe. So we're taking one of the most rare forms of energy. You can't run a Boeing 727 on solar power or wind. One of the most portable, concentrated forms of energy, making single-use containers out of them, using them once and throwing them in the ground. What would a Martian anthropologist say? Estúpido, yeah, verdad, muy estúpido, very stupid, very foolish. To take a fossil fuel, like oil, make beverage containers that are used once, and then put them in the ground to biodegrade in a very long time. Jordan's art is absolutely stunning and provocative, but he makes his points in ways that I have difficulty doing using English prose. Because pictures like this really do. This will probably be the one you'll remember a week from now. You'll forget everything I say, but you'll remember this photo. And there are many others like it. If this is your motto, this is natural behavior, right? The one follows from the other. Here's an alternative. Live simply, that others may simply live. What's the point? The third argument is what I call the 'tis a gift to be simple argument. From the old Shaker hymn, some of you may know that. 'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in that place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. It's set to a nice melody by Aaron Copland, famous American writer, musician, composer. 'Tis a gift to be simple, the joyful simplicity argument. Goes something like this. More is not necessarily better for our personal well-being or the earth. Indeed, living with simple elegance. This is a line from Bill McKibben, whose name you may know, a contemporary environmental activist, who, by the way, is a Christian. He's written a couple books with Christian publishing houses. A lot of people don't know that. He's a United Methodist, teaches Sunday school in his United Methodist Church in Vermont, where he lives. Living with simple elegance is more joyful than living caught in our consumer culture. Why care for creation? Because care for creation, we should care for creation because such an earth-friendly lifestyle is more joy-filled and joyful. Next argument. This photo could be, again, taken in any number of places. You see a dark-skinned child wandering on, it looks like a beach of some sort, with smokestacks in the background. Or this one from the south side of Chicago, not too long from here, not too far from here. Or here's the title of a now famous book by an African-American brother, Robert Bullard, Dumping in Dixie. The subtitle summarizes his argument, race, class, and environmental quality. What's the point? The fourth reason goes something like this, my name for it, Poor and Oppressed Unite, otherwise known since 1973 when this term was coined, the eco-justice argument. I'm quoting now from a famous study, Toxic Wastes and Race in the United States, a national report on the racial and socioeconomic characteristics of communities surrounding hazardous waste sites. Charles Lee was one of the main authors of that 1987 study, and this is a quote from that study. Because the racial composition of a community is a single variable best able to explain the existence or non-existence of commercial hazardous waste facilities in that area, we must make the link between environmental pollution and issues of racial and social equity. What this study did, if you know anything about statistics, was a regression analysis of toxic waste sites in this country and a whole host of other variables. Are there any positive correlations? And what they found was one variable popped out, namely race. In other words, tell me where the racial and ethnic minority folk live in any part of this country, and there's a high probability that that's where the toxic waste sites are. South side of Chicago, Sumter County, Alabama, Puerto Rico, lots of examples of a connection here. And lots of work by Bob Bullard and others since those days to document precisely this kind of connection. It's not just in the States. I know you Adventist brothers and sisters have people you know literally all over the world doing missionary work, living, preaching the gospel. In my journeys around the world and places, I find this also to be true. My first time in Nicaragua back in 87, beautiful day, Lake Managua, why is no one swimming in it? Well, it's polluted. In Belize, same thing, Central America. Connections, there are these connections between traditional, quote, social justice issues, poverty, racism, homelessness, and traditional, quote, environmental issues, water, air, endangered species. So much so that many of the national environmental organizations, Wilderness Society, Sierra Club, et cetera, now are doing better at making connections between the issues that they are traditionally concerned about and issues of race and ethnicity and so on. And likewise, traditional social justice organizations, Bread for the World, for example, are seeing the connections between hunger and environmental degradation. Why care for creation? In short, because the various forms of oppression that people experience because of the color of their skin, for example, and oppression of our non-human neighbors are of a piece. They're connected. All right, extra credit, bonus time. Biologists especially, ornithologists in particular, name that species. Most everyone in this room is old enough to have remembered the headlines from Pacific Northwest. I'm giving you a hint here. Northern spotted owl. Remember those days back in the 80s, early 90s? Loggers versus spotted owl. All right, this one even comes with a big red sign that says endangered. How about this one? Anyone been to the Shedd Aquarium lately? Recognize a beluga whale? What's the point? Argument 5 goes like this. Spotted owls have rights too. The animal rights argument. Because certain higher animals have the same relevant properties as humans, this is the argument in essence. In other words, sentience, I'll explain that in a minute, they too have the same rights. in the West, up until about the Revolutionary, no, more the War of 1812, up until the early 1800s, what qualified you as a rights bearer was rationality or reason. Until people like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill came along and said, you know, I think it's sentience, not rationality, that confers upon a living organism a right, a legitimate claim. Sentience is the capacity to suffer. The capacity to suffer. That's what gives something a right to exist. In all the organisms that you just looked at, the slides I had, are all organisms that are sentient, that have the capacity to suffer. We're not quite sure where on the phylogenetic scale you draw the line, but clearly your pet dog, I have one, Rosita, Rosie for short, and the pet cat, Loquita, Locoita, little crazy one in Spanish, and until recently, our chinchilla passed away last year, Bella, you see all these Spanish names. Probably Bella, too. I mean, if Bella were at Hope and involved a bunch of chinchillas in a laboratory experiment, I would have to sign off. I'm on the ethicist on the animal committee by law. Every college and university has to have such a committee if there's any experimentation on animals going on in the psychology or biology departments or anywhere else. So what about the fish? Probably not. The snake? Kella, no, probably not. Not sufficiently developed brain and neural system. But so maybe there's a fuzzy area in there somewhere. Clearly there are organisms below this line of sentience, and clearly there are non-human organisms that are sentient. So claim the proponents of this argument. If certain higher animals, like beluga whales or chimpanzees, have the same relevant properties like the capacity to suffer, then they too have the same rights. In other words, we should care for creation because certain kinds of non-human creatures are entitled to our care. Now, this is a very complicated issue, but we do in fact recognize, I think, the intuition behind this argument in our legal system. If you had a dog or a cat or a farm animal like some of the ones I passed on the drive, beautiful drive down here, and you were found to be abusing or neglecting that cow or horse, you could be fined or thrown into jail, right, for the, quote, inhumane treatment of animals. Whether or not they have rights or not, clearly there's something like that acknowledged in our legal system. So that's argument number 5. All right, who knows what this is besides the two humans in the front there? What's the organism in the back? A sequoia, and there are different kinds of sequoias. This is Sequoia dendron gigantea, the giant sequoia, the world's largest living organism, found in particular in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. There are also some in Yosemite, but this one is from Sequoia National Park. I mentioned I lived in L.A. for 4 years. My wife and I, wherever possible, got up into the mountains of California, often into places like this, where when you are, what, in front of a tree like this, it literally takes your breath away. It just stills you. Words fail. Trees that are, well, this is an awful big room. Usually I'm in a classroom, the tree is bigger than the classroom, bigger in circumference. These trees are 300 feet tall. These trees are older than Jesus. They were adults when Jesus walked the dusty trails of Galilee. Trees whose bark are 18 to 20 inches thick to protect the trees from fire, which is a necessary part of a giant sequoia ecology, right? It needs fire for those serotonous cones to fall and open. Fire ecology is crucial. These trees are not the same as the coastal redwoods. That's Sequoia sempervirens. Those are the tallest living things, the trees you see in Muir Woods north of San Francisco. These are the largest living things. There's another one. You can see some burn marks among the person in the front there. That is one huge tree. There's a view looking up. The branches up there are bigger around than any tree I've seen on your campus. The branches. 100 feet up. What's the point? The sixth reason to be an earth keeper. Value generates duty, the intrinsic value argument. It goes like this. Since there's intrinsic value in nature, and since the presence of such value generates duties for humans, we humans have obligations to care for non-human creatures. Let me explain. Intrinsic value means something has value over and above its usefulness to humans. Instrumental value means use value. That's a basic distinction made within environmental ecological ethics. Intrinsic value, instrumental value. You can have both. A tree has both, presumably. A tree is useful for providing wood for your floor in your kitchen, or wood for your fire to keep warm. But if you look at a sequoia tree, say, for example, and say, you know what? That tree is valuable not for any human use that we could think of, but simply because it is, if you believe in God, because God made it. You have just acknowledged that that tree has intrinsic value. Value over and above any usefulness it might have for humans. We cut down a bunch of these trees in the late 1800s. You know what we used them for? Fence posts. The trees often shattered on impact because the wood is actually quite soft. It's not very good wood. You don't want to build anything out of a sequoia tree. And then we had the common sense to stop cutting down these giants of the forest. Intrinsic value. This is an argument made most famously by Holmes Ralston III, for my money, the greatest living environmental ethicist and philosopher, who a lot of philosophers don't realize is an ordained Presbyterian minister. Retired from Colorado State just a few years ago. This argument says, forget about rights. We don't need to talk about rights language. The real question is value. And if a non-human organism like a sequoia tree, or maybe it's a white pine, Pinus strobus, our Michigan state tree, you have those here. If a tree has value over and above its usefulness to humans, then that value generates duties for us humans, regardless of whether that tree or other non-human organism has any rights. This argument just completely bypasses all those debates about rights. We humans have obligations to care for those non-human creatures that have intrinsic value. Now, that doesn't mean we have the same obligations to trees that we do to our children or human strangers. That gets into another discussion. Don't get me wrong on this, but the point is simply, if we acknowledge intrinsic value, then we have duties. And it's hard not to read Psalm 104 and acknowledge that non-human creatures have value. The Symphony of Creation Psalm. There are a whole bunch of psalms that talk about non-human creatures, but for my money, that's the clearest and the best. Read it sometime when you've got a minute and a half or so. It's a long psalm, but it talks about all these non-human creatures as if they have value simply because God made them, which means we have duties to protect them. Care for creation because creation is valuable for its own sake. Here's a simple grassland ecosystem showing different component parts. You see some decomposers in the abiotic and biotic material in the ground. You've got some first-level producers and then some carnivores and herbivores, some consumers of different sorts. Those are the three basic parts. Producers, consumers, and decomposers. We often forget about the decomposers, but we would be neck high and all kinds of stuff without all those decomposers, the beetles and the bacteria and all the rest. Here's another version, perhaps more symbolic, of how we are interrelated. A spider's web with morning dew. You touch just a part of it and the whole thing shimmers and shakes. Or maybe here's an even more symbolic view. The earth from space, all one planet, all interrelated, interconnected. Butterflies flapping their wings in Japan affect the weather here in southwestern Michigan. I'm not making that up. It's called the butterfly effect. We're all in this together, the seventh reason, otherwise known as the community of creation argument. All creatures are bound together in such a way that their flourishing is interdependent, so we should act in a way that enhances the life of the whole community. Aldo Leopold put it well in his famous book, Sand County Almanac. I'm quote, all ethics rest upon a single premise, that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. And from that, Leopold derives his famous ethical maxim, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, beauty, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. A thing is right, is ethically right, when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the entire biotic community. Or maybe John Muir. When you try to pick out anything by itself, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. I'm reading marvelous, relatively new biography of John Muir. Actually, I was reading this morning by Don Worster, famous environmental historian. When you try to pick out anything by itself, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. It's a basic law of ecology. Everything's related, connected, dependent many times on all kinds of other things, which leads to the canoeist's version of the golden rule. Do you know it? Treat those downstream of you as you would have those upstream treat you. Because we all live, do we not, upstream and downstream of everyone else. In some cases, literally on rivers and watersheds. In all cases, in terms of wind and air. So Ottawa County, where I live in the summer, has ozone action days, ozone alert days. We had about 8 or 9 last summer. And it's not because of the automobiles so much, primarily the automobiles in Ottawa County, but it's from this certain large Midwestern city that is west of us, about Chicago. A lot of the air pollution along the West Coast originates in Chicago. Ludington State Park 4 summers ago had more ozone action days than the city of Chicago itself. And it wasn't because the folks in Ludington were doing a lot of driving. The prevailing winds were from the southwest. And now acid rain's being detected in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. It's not coming from Seattle. You want to take a guess where that's coming from? China. Because the air hasn't learned how to read a map or observe international boundaries. And the prevailing westerly winds are bringing a lot of that sulfuric acid, turns into sulfur dioxide, turns into sulfuric acid, and it's falling in places that heretofore had not known any acid rain. And in my beloved Adirondacks, the acid rain that I see affecting the forests there, especially the birch trees, is not coming from Syracuse or Rochester or New York City. It's coming from Michigan and Indiana and Ohio and Illinois. All creatures are bound together in such a way that their and our flourishing is interdependent. As Joe Sittler said, I wrote a whole bunch on Joe Sittler in my doctoral dissertation years ago. He's a famous Lutheran theologian from the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Here's a famous Sittler quote. I've never been able to entertain an idea of God which is not integrally related to the fact of chipmunks, squirrels, hippopotamuses, galaxies, and light years. Sittler was a pioneering ecological theologian writing in the 1930s and 40s, long before Earth Day, long before Rachel Carson's bombshell book, Silent Spring. Writing about the connections between theology and ecology and the reasons Christians in particular have to be earthkeepers. So we should care for creation because such care is in the best interests of creation as a whole. Now let's just pause for a minute. There are three more reasons. But notice where we've come, reason one to reason seven. We started with self-interest, one human person. And now we're taking into account all of creation. The scope of what counts, morally speaking, has expanded to include virtually all living organisms. And again, that doesn't mean that all living organisms have the same value. It simply means they are now moral patients, to use the language of ecological ethics. They must be considered, not just me, not just my kids, not just only humans, not just only sentient organisms, but now, if you go with Leopold or Walston, even whole ecosystems. You can't just talk about moose and wolves, you got to talk about the whole greater Yellowstone ecosystem, for example. And notice now, with my invocation of Psalm 104, we've gone from mostly, what, non-religious arguments to arguments that now have religious and, yes, Christian versions. Genesis 2:15. And the Lord God, one translation, took the man, the Adam, and put him in the Garden of Eden to dress it and keep it, to avad and shamar, reads the Hebrew, to serve and protect. Which is why I call this the Chicago Police Cruiser verse, because that's what it says on the side of every Chicago cop car. Within a month of living in Chicago, I learned that the motto in Chicago is vote early, vote often, where even the dead vote, usually more than once. I'm just telling you what I learned as a grad student at the University of Chicago years ago, 20 years ago almost. And in the Chicago police car, I was pleased to see it says to serve and protect. They're quoting the Bible. Do they know that? That's Genesis 2:15, the last clause. The Lord God took the Adam and put the Adam in the Garden of Eden to avad and shamar, to serve and protect. It's hard to see here, but it's right, well, I got my pointer here, I can use that, right there, to serve and protect. And in Holland, Michigan, until recently, they have some new vehicles, until recently in my hometown now, Holland, Michigan, that's what it says on their police cars too. And in almost every U.S. city, wherever I go, I try to find a police car. And it apparently is some sort of informal police motto. Because in most of the cities, on their cars, somewhere you can read, usually protect and serve or serve and protect. Somebody needs to tell these people according to the Bible. That is the job of Adam, according to Genesis 2. And where does that name come from? Adam is a pun in the Hebrew. Earlier in Genesis 2, the text tells us that the Lord God made the Adam from the Adama, from the dirt, from the soil. We are earth creatures. Humans from the humus. It works in Latin as well. We lose it, of course, when we translate it into English. We lose the pun. We lose the play. Adam from the Adama, humans from the humus. And our God-given task is to serve and protect the earth. So here's a book by a friend of mine, Cal DeWitt, just retired from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, one of the premier conservation programs in the country there, caring for creation, responsible stewardship of God's handiwork. What's the point? Argument 8 or reason 8 is God says so. The divine command argument. Since God commands that we care for creation in places like Genesis 2:15, and since authentic faith requires obedience to God, no Christian's gonna argue with that, I presume. We should care for creation as part of our Christian discipleship. It's part of what it means to be a Christian, to serve and protect. It's not all of what it means. Lots of other things that God calls us to do, don't get me wrong. But it's one thing. Part of our Christian discipleship. We should care for creation because God says so. And it's, once you have the eyes to see, it's all over in the Bible. Leviticus 25, we're called to give the land a Sabbath. In the year of Jubilee, we take the whole monopoly board, we throw the pieces in the air and start all over again, right? And Jesus invokes the year of Jubilee in his inaugural address. Our president just gave an inaugural. Jesus had an inaugural. It's in Luke 4. And he quotes Isaiah 61, which quotes Leviticus 25. It's all about the year of the Lord. That's a thinly veiled reference to the year of Jubilee. Excessive exploitation is prohibited in order to preserve the land's fruitfulness. So, why care for creation? Because God says so. Number 9. We come in all shapes and sizes and skin colors, we humans. And we're called to be God's image bearers, Genesis 1, among other places in the Bible. Reflecting God's image, like this lake reflecting a snow-capped mountain. And God's concerns are to be our concerns. All right, biologists, any ornithologist here? What do we have? Or any arborist? What kind of tree? This is also from Psalm 104, for example, if I give you a hint. It's a fir tree, someone said it, and those are storks. Psalm 104, verse 17, refers to storks in a fir tree. And this is in Israel. There are about 600,000 storks migrate, often perching like these in a fir tree. What's the point? Reason 9 is God's concerns are, or ought to be, our concerns. The image of God argument. Humans are meant to be God's image bearers, Genesis 1, 26 through 28. And since being an image bearer of God involves caring for the needs of others, including, I would argue, our non-human neighbors, we must show concern for more than just humans. God clearly shows concern for more than just humans. We should care for creation because God's concerns for other creatures ought also to be our concerns. So our care should include humid wetlands and arid deserts, the beautiful western prairie orchid and the not-so-pretty Houston toad, soaring bald eagles, and the American bearing beetle. God cares about marmots, mountains, and meadows, and so, therefore, should we. Number 10, and last. This is a photo I took on my last sabbatical. I spent some time hiking in the North Cascades in Washington State, a place that I'd visited but never extensively hiked. What a beautiful place. Jaw-dropping beauty. Majestic. Kind of like those giant sequoias. But not just the majestic, the sublime of monarch butterfly in your backyard. You don't need to travel to Washington State to see the beauty of the earth. It's everywhere. Take your pick. And this is just our country, this particular collage of 16 photos. For the beauty of the earth. That's the 10th and last reason I want to put before you today. Otherwise known as the grateful heart argument. Care for creation is a fitting response of gratitude for creatures like us who experience God's bountiful and gracious provisions. In response to the gifts of earth and sky, hill and vale and tree and flower, I'm quoting now from that old hymn for the beauty of the earth. Some of you know it. Sun and moon and stars and light, in response to these gifts, we sing, Lord of all, to thee we raise. This our hymn of grateful praise. When my daughters were little, they'd often come home from school. Some of you will relate to this. I'm sure you have these memories. And they would hand me, a work of art from second grade, "Here, Daddy, look at this." And I would do two things, the same thing you did. I would say, "Thank you, Anna, Cara, Sophia," whichever of my daughters it was. And I'd give him a big hug, and I'd prominently display that work of art, you know where, on the refrigerator. And some of them are still there, even though my daughters are much older now. Or in my office, on the back side of the door, when it's closed, there's their artwork. Not worth a dime on eBay, and I'd never put it on eBay or anywhere else. Maybe one way we can show our gratitude, say thanks to God, is by caring for what God has given us. Certainly the life, ministry, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus figures prominently into that for us Christians. But we in the Reformed tradition talk not just about special grace, but about common grace, not just about special revelation, but general revelation. One of our confessions even talks about two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature. This argument says one way that we can say thanks to God for the gift of this beautiful earth on which we live and move and have our being, one way we can say thank you is by caring for it. We should care for creation because grace begets gratitude and gratitude begets care. So why care for creation? Conclusion. For many reasons. Many good reasons. One, because our own existence is imperiled. Two, because we owe it to our children. Three, because an earth-friendly way of life is more joyful. Four, because various forms of oppression are of a piece. Five, because certain non-human creatures are entitled to our care. Six, because creation is valuable for its own sake. Seven, because it's in the best interest of creation as a whole. Eight, because God says so. Nine, because we are God's image bearers. 10, because grace begets gratitude, and gratitude begets care. Because in summary, care for creation is an integral part of what it means to be a Christian, an important part of our piety, our spirituality, our collective way of being authentically Christian. Joseph Sittler articulately captures the heart of this affirmation, and with this quote, I conclude. Joe writes, "When we turn the attention of the church to a definition of the Christian relationship with the natural world, we are not stepping away from grave and proper theological ideas. We are, rather, stepping right into the middle of them. There is a deeply rooted, genuinely Christian motivation for attention to God's creation, despite the fact that many church folk consider ecology to be a secular concern. Quote, what does environmental preservation have to do with Jesus Christ and his church? End quote. These folk ask. They could not be more shallow or more wrong. Thank you.
Okay, some questions.
Thank you for these beautiful imperatives. How would you respond to someone who says, if a species disappears, that's just natural selection at work.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just let nature take its course?
Nature take its course. That's an excellent question. Because, in fact, if you believe the fossil record, among other things, species have, in fact, gone extinct naturally. That is to say, not caused by humans. But you know what? The rate of species extinction right now is 100 times the background natural extinction rate. That's in chapter 2 of my book. And projections are, if business continues as usual, in other words, if we do nothing different in the next 100 years, it will be 1,000 to 10,000 times the background extinction rate. In other words, anthropogenic, human-caused extinction rates are much, much higher, orders of magnitude higher than the background extinction rate. So, yeah, extinction per se, nothing necessarily wrong with that. But when there are three extinctions of flora or fauna a day, that's a lot higher than the natural rate. And that's the best estimate I've found. So since we all had breakfast this morning, another one's gone extinct. And by the time we're worshiping today, tomorrow, tonight, by the time we have breakfast tomorrow, another two, three a day. That's low. E.O. Wilson, prominent biologist, puts it much higher than that. This is fauna and flora. And biodiversity is the original World Wide Web. We can all get along just fine. We really can without the internet. The most important World Wide Web is biodiversity. And we are causing extinctions at a rate far beyond the background rate. And that's one of the top three degradations that I find. You read a lot of the people, that's one of the three that shows up on everyone's short list as one of the most important. Because once a species is gone, it's gone. We will never again see a passenger pigeon. Last one died in the Cleveland Zoo in, 13, 14? It's gone. Pigeon Lake, Pigeon River, just north of where I live, no more passenger pigeons. You foul the Kalamazoo River, as has been done, right, with carcinogenic material, you can fix it. It'll be expensive, but you can bring it back. Or if you contaminate Muskegon Lake, where I grew up in Muskegon, you can fix it. The air now is better in LA than it was when I lived there in the mid-80s. But a species, it's gone, it's gone. So there's something about species extinction that's irreversible. So, good question. Yeah, another one in the back.
I appreciate your comments on this. I've got kind of a twin or a follow-up to this discussion that you've given us. A ditto, if you will. How do you answer the sentiment that man is not capable, it's arrogance to think that man is capable of harming the environment or creating climate change or anything of that nature?
That we're too full of ourselves, are we, if we think that we can cause devastations? Well, yeah, it is. I've read that and I've heard it. I get around, and I've had people make that challenge. Well, you could talk about any number of different ecological degradations and just simply show that that's not the case. We did, in fact, extinguish the passenger pigeon. And there are only a few kiwis left in the kiwi land, actual kiwis in New Zealand, right? I teach in New Zealand regularly, and I've been to a kiwi preserve. There are only a few of those birds left. And the moa's gone, big flightless bird. I mean, the Polynesians, not the European, not the folks from Europe, but the Polynesians destroyed the moa. So there are, I think, clear examples with respect to loss of biodiversity of ways in which we humans have, in fact, in the past, done a lot of damage. And that's not even talking about the much more controversial issue of global climate change. But that's where I would go next, probably, to talk about the effects that we have. Many climate scientists are now talking about the fact that we are now living in the Anthropocene. We've entered a new geologic era. Anthropocene from anthropos, the Greek word for human. An era in which humans have and continue to exert an inordinate influence or power to shape the planet on which we live. Yes?
In the list of the 10 richest Americans are four Walmart heirs.
Oh, really? Wow.
What is the Christian way of dealing with these mega places like Walmart that break most of those rules?
Oh, mercy. I'll try to keep it short. Well, truth be told, it's a mixed picture when it comes to Walmart, because Walmart in the last 2 years, maybe you know this, has put pressure on its suppliers to, quote, go green. And it has more effect than almost any other organization, public or private, in the world in doing that. So there's been some real progress made with respect to sustainability when it comes to Walmart. On the other hand, they have been noted, you probably all know this, this has been in the papers over the last decades or so, not particularly, they have not treated their employees particularly well in lots of ways, and it is not an organization that in the eyes of many people until recently has been much concerned about sustainability. You have economic issues of putting other organizations, local businesses, for example, out of business when the local Walmart moves in. There are a whole host of reasons that people are critical of a big business operation like that. But truth be told, there has been some good, as I mentioned, with respect to Walmart in particular. If you can persuade those in power to take some steps towards sustainability, it could be really powerful. I could say a lot more on that, but yes.
Thank you very much. Very beautifully and articulately done.
Thank you.
What do we face given the population growth in my lifetime from fewer than 2 billion to more than 7?
Right.
How, with this consumption of resources, the far production of carbon dioxide and other gases, what is the hope for the future that you see? And how can we cope with these issues?
It's an excellent question. Is it okay? Is there a blackboard behind one of these screens?
There is.
Can I put one up? Because you still have the other one.
I don't know how to put it up. I'm sorry.
Maybe there's a...
It's electric.
Okay.
It is electric.
All right. If not, then that's okay. I was going to put a formula on the blackboard. Population is huge. It's the first issue that I mentioned in Chapter 2, where I take the vital signs of the planet, Chapter 2 of my book. And you're right, we've gone from 2 billion to 7.1, 7.2 billion people. A question I often give my students is, when were there half as many people on the planet, 1800, 1900, or 1965? The answer is 1965. We have exponential population growth. Indeed, we now are at about 7.2 billion people. This is an issue that almost everybody brings up because of our ecological footprint, especially those of us in the wealthier countries of the world. That being said, that human population growth has an enormous impact, environmental impact, on the planet. That being said, the formula is this, IPAT. I equals PAT. Environmental impact equals population, human population, times affluence, consumption per person, per capita, times technology, some sort of technological coefficient, right? Technological efficiency. In other words, there are at least three variables, not just one, when it comes to measuring environmental impact. So even with increasing human population growth, if we consumed less per person, especially in this country, and or became more technologically efficient with how we heat our buildings, light our buildings, drive our vehicles, the impact could actually stabilize or go down even with increasing human population, theoretically. So that's not to excuse it or say we shouldn't address it, but simply to say that those folks who say that really the only effect is population, so now we get controversial here and elsewhere around the world, we need to reduce human population by either coercive or non-coercive means, right? Coercive, i.e. one-child policy in China, non-coercive, contraceptive devices And the Vatican and other organizations have spoken out about this often, right? So, but just bracket the whole issue of human population, important as that is. Assume it continues to rise exponentially, and it will level out, scientists say, demographers, probably at around 9 or 10 billion people in 30 to 60 years. Nevertheless, there are these other factors, which we have some control over. You have fluorescent lights in this building, not incandescents. That's good. I predict in 10 years there'll be LEDs, because you'll see that it's simply more energy efficient, and the bottom line is that they'll save you money. Whole cities are now converting to LED lights, light emitting diodes, because they're so much more energy efficient. And the President Obama, in the last 4 years, upped the CAFE standards, right? Corporate average fuel efficiency standards, so that in, 10 years, the average fuel efficiency will be 35 miles per hour rather than 20. And of course, we now have hybrids. I passed a few of them on the highway on the way here that are getting 40 to 50 to 60 miles per gallon. So all that to say is there are technological efficiencies that we're only just beginning to put into place. And there's the ever-present issue of affluence, which is, again, is short for consumption per capita. And again, it's not all bad news here. Recycling in this country is now cutting into the rate at which we're dumping stuff into the ground in landfills. I don't have slides for that, but that's another slideshow. So all that to say is that impact, population is very important when it comes to environmental impact, but it's not the only variable. Yes, another question.
I want to thank you for your presentation. I want you to know when I teach Fundamentals of Christian Ethics, I use your book because I'm stuck in a section on ecology, and it's real hard to twist some people's arms. Students come very strongly influenced against it, but I insist on doing it. But
good. Where do you teach?
Here at the seminary.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Good.
And looking at your wonderful reasons for care, I would like to wonder if you could amplify number five.
Sure.
Animals have rights too. What about the vegetarian diet? What we know about modern animal husbandry, the cruelty to steer, to
right.
chickens, to pigs, to all these animals is so bad. It's just so wrong. And also, beyond diet, what about fracking? I hear controversial things and all the water that's being used for that.
Right.
And I just wonder if you could speak to those issues.
Good. There are seven reasons. No. Yes, right, seven. Seven reasons to become a vegetarian. I won't give that lecture today. I'll do that some other time, maybe. I am? Yeah, I know. Adventist place. I've been a vegetarian, lacto-ovo-vegetarian I'm so old, I got to do the math now, 35 years. I became a vegetarian having taken a religion class at Hope College. And my entree was I learned a number of, to me, disturbing facts. Like, there's enough food in the world, this is back in the 70s, to feed all those hungry people. But a lot of that, in this country, corn, was being fed to cattle to beef them up at big lots in places like Omaha. And that if you learn a little ecology, you know that 90% of the energy gets lost as you go up the trophic system, right? 90% gets lost of that corn once it's eaten by a cow to put fat so I could have my Big Mac. And in light of the fact that there were so many hungry people, today a line of the hungry shoulder to shoulder goes around the world to the equator 14 times. 14 times around the equator. That's stunning. And it just hit me as a college junior, I was, that there's something wrong with this picture. And that maybe if I and a few hundred or thousand or million other people just ate a little lower on the food chain, that there'd be a little more food left over for all those hungry folks. So a kind of food injustice argument was my entree. And then after 11 years, my wife and I in graduate school at various places, you know, where you're on a graduate school budget, it's just cheaper not to eat meat. I mean, heck with the ethical arguments. We couldn't afford it. So there's another argument, and I could give a whole bunch. I mean, men in the room, what's one of the largest causes of mortality among American males? Heart disease. Arterial and atherosclerosis. What causes that? diet high in animal fat. So I said, hey, I want to, you know, live as long as possible, Lord willing, and live healthily. So, I mean, there are all these arguments, and there are seven or more, to become a vegetarian, or at least to eat less meat. And even among meats, it makes a difference, right? Beef is the one you ought to give up first. You can still eat some chicken, maybe, although, again, you get arguments. Another argument is, well, how are the animals raised? I had a buddy who went to a slaughterhouse. He never ate meat again after going to the slaughterhouse. He saw how, in this case, cows were slaughtered. So, and then if you look at the religions of the world, I'm preaching to the choir here, you're, I'm sure, aware of all this, virtually every religion, there are admonitions about diet and often about not eating a lot of meat. So, good question. Oh, yes, fracking. Whoops. How did that happen? I touched the screen. Yeah, the touch screen here. Fracking is, I think, a really bad idea from what research I've done. I haven't researched it extensively, but it's a huge issue here, Pennsylvania, upstate New York. And, I mean, there are too many reports now about water table contamination. I just think we're playing with fire. Furthermore, the gas, the natural gas that's being mined by this process, fracturing is the full name, right, is a fossil fuel. And while it's the cleanest of the fossil fuels, there's only one carbon atom, right, CH4. If you have to burn a fossil fuel, burn methane rather than petroleum or coal. Nevertheless, it produces carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. Now right back to the discussion about climate change. And the fact that we're up around, we're pushing 400 parts per million CO2, and we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere in the last 50 years, in my lifetime. And the evidence there is I think, quite solid. The fifth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report is going to come out in a couple months, IPCC report, the definitive scientific analysis, and from what I've heard and read so far, it's going to just further cement what they said in 2007 with the fourth report, which is that greenhouse gases have in fact increased. Humans are not the only but the largest contributors to that, and that's what's causing all the quote weird weather. I realize that's controversial, but that I think is the scientific consensus on global climate change. So back to fracking. I mean, we're probably going to have to use methane as a transition fuel to get away from coal and oil until we've got better ways to produce large amounts of energy. In nuclear energy, I drove by the nuclear plant on the way here, right, just south of South Haven. There are three good reasons not to go nuclear. It's incredibly expensive. What about the waste, which we still haven't figured out where to put it all in this country? And what about accidents, which we've had? Three Mile Island, for example.
I'm neither articulate nor beautiful in my speech. I flunk lots of English classes. But I've got several items here that I'd like to just address.
Okay.
And then you can pick and choose whichever ones you think are most important to respond to.
Okay.
Genesis 1 and 2, it talked about the creation. And my understanding is that the whole earth, whatever he put in place was put in here, and we were given dominion. It was for us, not for anything else, and for us to exploit. Ayn Rand, who a lot of religions castigate, it said this last part of number one up there. She was very strongly in self-interest. I believe that there would be a fulcrum where a person could make good decisions from. As far as on the police cars, you talked about serve and protect.
Yep.
And I think that as a policeman walks there, he's reminded that he is there to serve himself and protect his bosses. That's what I see. I might be wrong on that. Banks also talk from their point of view. They say they're going to credit your account. Well, that means it's a liability on their books, not yours. let's see here. You said that we should do things because God said so. I happen to believe that the reason why God said so was to edify us, not give us demarcations and commands for the purpose of controlling or manipulation. Mm-hmm. Guilt as a tool, I think, has been shown to be ineffective and, for the most part, really doesn't work. I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. I'll try to respond to a couple of them. First one, Genesis 1:26-28. What does it mean to say when the text says that we are given dominion? Many people for a very long time have interpreted that as domination, including many Christians. Rada is the Hebrew word for rule. Kabash is the word used, translated once, as subdue. Verse 28. Maybe you've heard or are familiar with the expression, put the kibosh on it. Right? That's from the Hebrew. Actually, through Yiddish, German Jews, their language. So, it's been interpreted that way. Dominion. We are given dominion. We humans made in God's image. This is the Genesis 1 story. But what do you do with Genesis 2? Where we're Adam from the Adama. Where we're called to serve and protect. What do you make of Psalm 72, where the psalmist describes the rule of a just and righteous king? Nowhere in Psalm 72 is this ruler given the right to dominate. What do you do with Jesus? The first shall be last, the last shall be first. James and John elbowing each other. Who's, make us first. Make us chief of staff, your secretary of state. What does Jesus do? Sets him down, pulls up a child and says, be like a child. No one that I'm aware of accuses Jesus of being a ruler who dominates. He serves. That's what good rulers do. That's what good department chairs do, good deans do, good presidents do. I hope you have them in abundance here. I don't know, but I hope you do. I'm fortunate to have a whole bunch of servant leaders at Hope College. I'm a department chair. My dean retires this year after 39 years of service, not all as dean. Jim Boltman retires this year, our president, a model of a servant leader. So I know the legacy. I've read a lot of the folks, Christians included, for the last 2,000 years. People like Bacon in the middle of the 17th century, or Descartes, who talk about Descartes, I'm quoting, us as masters and possessors of nature. I just can't see that. I don't read that in the Bible. I don't see it in Genesis 1. Yes, we're called to rule, but we are to rule as a servant, as a dom who knows that we are made from Adama, that all those other earth creatures are kinfolk of ours because we're all made from the same stuff. So, guilt, I think guilt's probably a poor tool to motivate also. And I don't know if you're thinking any of those arguments are using guilt, but short-term guilt probably works. Long-term, I don't think it does. We have to be motivated by something like gratitude, the last argument, right? Which moves beyond command. And actually, so does number two. I don't do certain things because God's commanded me to make the world a better place for my children. I do it because I love my kids, or at least I try to, and you do too. You do it because of your affection and care for your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. Ayn Rand is I'm not a fan of hers. We could talk more about her philosophy, Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead and all the rest, but I think going that direction is a bad move. I'll stop with that.
Can I ask you a maybe this will be the last question.
Okay.
I think you've made a great case for a Christian view of ecology, but
right.
you deal a little bit with this in your book. Not all of our fellow Christians are so convinced.
Right.
Despite the eloquence of your argument, many Christians disagree completely with the view that we should take care of the earth. It's all going to get burned up anyway, is one argument.
Right.
How would you, what more could you say to our fellow Christian believers who disagree with the view that we should care for the earth?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that a lot. My question would be, first question to anyone who would argue against this would be, so give me some reasons why you think we shouldn't. And often the reason given, especially at Christian colleges and universities, is the one you just alluded to, namely some sort of argument having to do with eschatology. An argument that goes something along the lines you're suggesting. When Jesus comes again, the earth, Christians will be raptured off the earth, and the earth will be burned up to nothing, quoting a favorite mistranslation of 2 Peter 3:10, the most egregious mistranslation in the Bible, I think. God's going to start all over again and make a new earth. So why in it? And usually the next premise, that's going to happen soon, or at least sooner than later. So why should we Christians care? And in fact, one prominent secular environmentalist in one of his books, University of California, Santa Barbara professor, Rod Nash, who's very well known, in his chapter on religion, in one of his books, he cites that argument as a critic by saying, yeah, it stands to reason Christians don't care about the earth. They believe a vengeful God is going to wipe the earth, you know, destroy the earth. Christians will be raptured off the planet, so why care about it? He basically thinks all Christians believe a kind of Tim LaHaye, Jerry Jenkins, Left Behind series eschatology. And I know those brothers are Christians, but I don't see that eschatology as being biblical. So if that were the main reason, then I would go after that argument by looking at those texts in the Bible, starting with 1 Thessalonians 4, the so-called rapture text, and show how if you read the Greek, it's exactly the opposite. That text is exactly the opposite of how it's interpreted by Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye. And in Revelation, the New Jerusalem, do we go up to it, or does it come down to us? Take a guess. Katabanusin, it descends to us. And this stunning text, vision of the new heaven and new earth in the last two chapters of the Bible, I mean, it's an earthly vision. And don't forget, the Bible begins and ends with rivers and trees. There's a sermon waiting to be preached. I know of only one person who's ever preached it. Well, two. Me and a former student. I mean, rivers and trees, Genesis 1 and 2, Revelation 21, 22. So with Christians, I typically, especially, I mean, I'm an evangelical, so the Bible's important to me. And with evangelicals, I go to Scripture, which I try to do, you know, in chapter 4. And let's look at these texts. Prove me wrong from the Bible. And many of these texts have been, I think, misinterpreted. And the classic example is the 1 Thessalonians 4 text about the rapture. And I grew up being taught that. I know dispensationalism and that particular view of things inside out, but when I actually started in college and later in seminary looking to these texts, I was sort of embarrassed to discover that what I was taught as a kid wasn't biblical. I mean, so.
Okay. Allusion has been made to his book. I just want to make one last plug for this. This is a fabulous piece of writing. I don't know Professor Steve. We're not related. He's not he's not paying me any money.
I hadn't paid you ahead of time.
He had paid me ahead of time. This is a fabulous book. He takes complex theological and ethical arguments He takes the science, the ecology, he distills it in smooth, easy to read prose, and it's not that big, slightly less than 200 pages, and not that expensive. I highly recommend it. If you want an argument for why we should take care of the earth from a Christian perspective, this is it. I mean that seriously. It's fabulous. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Thank you all.